Here at Spiked, we believe that ideas matter. That's why we're happy to announce that this episode of the Spiked podcast is sponsored by the Monk Debates, a platform for great minds to discuss the most important issues of our time. The Monk Debates are about challenging conventional wisdom, interrogating groupthink, and the next Monk Debate on anti-Zionism will do just this. On the 17th of June, commentator Douglas Murray, broadcaster Mehdi Hassan and others will discuss whether anti-Zionism is a form of anti-Semitism. The debate will be taking place in downtown Toronto in Canada, but Monk Debates supporters can live stream the event for free. And that's not all you get if you become a Monk Debates supporter. You can also get access to 15 years worth of debates from the Monk archives. Past debates have explored the meaning of populism, the rise of China, the flaws of liberalism, and more. The Monk debates also draw in world-renowned thinkers from journalist Sourabh Amari to psychologist Steven Pinker. For just $9.99 Canadian dollars, or just under £6 a month, you can become a Monk Debates supporter. That'll get you loads of extra perks, like being able to buy tickets before the general public. Plus, you can live stream in-person events at no extra cost, and you'll also get exclusive access to the Monk Debates archives. For a limited time only, Monk Debates are offering a 10% discount on supporter membership for fans of this podcast. Just use the code SPIKED10 at the checkout to get 10% off. So, to find out more and claim your supporter discount, go to monkdebates.com. That's M-U-N-K, debates.com. And don't forget to use the discount code SPIKED10 to get 10% off. That's code SPIKED10 at the checkout at monkdebates.com. Hello and welcome back to the Spiked podcast. I'm Fraser Myers, and with me as ever, I'm joined by Spiked editor Tom Slater.
Hello.
And we're delighted to be joined by an extra special guest, legendary comedy writer Graham Linehan.
Hello, thank you.
Thanks for coming on. So coming up today, we've got loads to discuss. We've got the surprise UK general election, the trans activist takeover of a rape crisis centre, and the turmoil in the Middle East from Israel to Iran. So Rishi Sunak has finally done it. He's taken the plunge and called an election for the 4th of July. Let's take a little look at his big speech outside Downing Street.
Some of you will only just be starting to feel the benefits. And for some, it might still be hard when you look at your bank balance. But this hard-earned economic stability was only ever meant to be the beginning.
It's even funnier.
Did they play it during the speech? They played things are only going to get better.
They drowned out the entire speech, pretty much. Yep.
It's from the gates of Downing Street. Steve Bray and his protest troop just blasting it.
It was strange that no one even came out and put an umbrella over him. So I thought, wow, his team really hate him. But then I remembered, of course, it's a Labour anthem.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, rained on, drowned out. Yeah. Good start to the campaign, Tom?
I think it's fantastic. I mean, that couldn't have gone any worse if Keir Starmer like scripted it or something. Yeah. It was, in terms of a sort of visual metaphor for a pathetic government that can't help but fail at everything, that rainy press conference really took the biscuit. But, I mean, I'm glad he's called the election, as far as it had to happen at some point. I mean, he has been kind of squatting in number 10 for almost 600 days without a mandate of his own. That's never a good thing. It had obviously become abundantly clear to his own team that as bad as things were, things could only get worse, to coin a phrase. Like, given the fact that they were still kind of dogged by fears about more defections, maybe, you know, clearly not very confident that the economic indicators are actually going to be felt by anyone. But it does just underline what little they have to offer. I mean, all he was left with was basically the element of surprise.
Yeah.
And that was it. But I think it's... just balancing that is the sense that there's clearly no excitement for this election, because the fact that I think even though people are quite resigned to a Labour victory, no one genuinely believes that a change in government will change things that dramatically.
The only dramatic change that might happen, because I agree there's a paper, cigarette paper between them.
Yeah.
If Labour gets in, it'll be far, far worse for women.
Yeah.
You know, because there's been no indication, as far as I could see, that Labour show any regret for the way their activists have been treating Rosie Duffield. In fact, they had a recent soiree in Kent, I think, which is where Rosie is MP, and they didn't invite her. Mm. You know, so you've got like, I don't know. I mean, I know it's not the key thing for many people. I found that out to my cost. But like, it is... It's the only significant difference that I can see.
It is a dividing line. And I think, you know, if you broaden it out to the question of identity politics generally, you could say that, yes, Labour is slightly worse on these issues, or maybe even a lot more, you know, a lot worse on these issues. I mean, you know, it's not just the trans question. There's going to be a Racial Equality Act, which is kind of going to bring DEI stuff through the back door, even while that is, you know, being discredited the world over. As you say, you mentioned, you know, trans, they're kind of proposing bringing a kind of form of self-ID, not full-blown self-ID, but through the back door.
Basically, your kind of local doctor can do it, can just sign you off.
Yes. Any better if he doesn't want to get his head kicked in.
Yeah, exactly. You know? And or net zero or something like that. You know, they both agree on it, but the Tories are slightly more wary of it. I mean, you know, Tom, what do you make of that?
Well, I think the problem is, because you're absolutely right, there are some clear dividing lines. The gender one is really quite stark. Anything kind of identity politics related. Keir Starmer's team clearly know that they have to try and shift closer towards the common sense public position on these things. But at the same time, their base of support, the sort of people who are really the main constituency of the Labour Party now, kind of the metropolitan upper middle classes really, are really in favour of this stuff.
Yeah.
And they will drag them further in that direction, kicking and screaming if necessary. I think the difficulty is that a lot of people have looked at the Conservatives and have concluded that at best they can slow this stuff down by a few years. And I think that was really summed up by the other day. You had one of these supposedly brilliant announcements from the government, which is that they're finally going to bring in sex education guidance, and that therefore we're not going to teach your kids crazy gender stuff until they're at least nine. You know, that was kind of the conclusion of it. And I know that they're taking gender out of the equation there, but I think it was a reminder of the fact that it feels too little too late for some people.
Yeah.
But then again, like the Conservatives immediately changed the rules at the NHS to make sure that they weren't prescribing puberty blockers to under 16. And you have to understand that's a huge, huge moment. And I'm saying this, sorry, so patronizing, you have to understand, but I know that it's a huge moment because I was just recently in Australia and the mood from the beginning of the trip to the end of the trip completely changed because people were so energized and so excited and so happy about the NHS is, like the BBC, regardless of how much they've been trashing their reputation with gender stuff, they are still very significant institutions abroad. So when they make a change like that, you're going to see a domino effect all through the world. And we already have been, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And what do you make of Keir Starmer as a figure, our next prime minister, if the polls are anything to be believed? Someone we can trust, someone we can...
I'll never vote for him. There's a thing in script writing called show, don't tell, which you might have heard of.
And yeah.
It basically means that if I get angry, I kick this table over, although I wouldn't have the strength, instead of telling you that I'm angry, you know? Keir Starmer is a master of tell, don't show. You know, his party will say anything because they've already proved they could say anything when people like David Lammy get on screen and say that men can grow a cervix, you know. So they've proved that they will just say anything. So it really is in the actions, and the only action they need to do to get a little bit closer to the centre is apologise to Rosie Duffield. They have to say sorry. She has received incredible abuse from lunatics in her party, who are the same lunatics who are now saying that the Cass Review isn't a robust study, you know. So I don't like him. I'll never vote for him. I don't trust him, and I certainly don't trust him on women's rights. And I'm a kind of single issue voter, as you might know.
I also think that a lot of people in the country don't trust him as far as they can throw him in terms of Keir Starmer. I mean, it's been quite striking how you hear all of this discussion about this incredible poll lead, it's about 20-point average at the moment, which is why it feels so mad that anyone would call an election with that being the kind of scores on the board. But there's clearly no enthusiasm for him. The atmosphere is already incredibly damp. It was quite clear from the local elections that whilst you are seeing these kind of historic swings to Labour, that's in the context of some quite historic low turnout. You saw that in the Blackpool South by-election, which had an incredibly low voter turnout. If you look at where the Tory vote from 2019 is going, its primary beneficiary is don't know. That's where most of those voters are who are defecting are going. There's a slither that's going to Reform. There's an even smaller slither that are going to the Labour Party. So it's quite clear that those Red Wall voters, those working class voters who took a chance on Boris Johnson for the first time ever, are not rushing back into Keir Starmer's sort of nasally technocratic embrace. And I think that will be found out in some way, shape or form. I would be amazed if he didn't win this election. I mean, if anyone could lose it in from this position of strength, maybe he is the person. But he has been handed it on a plate. But at the same time, even if he wins quite handsomely, it will be a lead that's oddly soft.
Yeah.
And I think his first year in office could potentially be quite fraught with peril for him because of the fact that he doesn't have that kind of strong support in the country. And he also has no real program to speak of.
Yeah.
And to the extent that his party does have firm positions on things, they're bad positions on things in relation to gender or any other issues we might talk about.
Right, let's talk a little bit about Edinburgh Rape Crisis Centre. So there's an extraordinary employment tribunal concluded earlier this week, essentially found that aside from discriminating against an employee for gender-critical beliefs, that this Rape Crisis Centre was really just putting gender ideology ahead of patient needs, you know, turning women away if they wanted to be seen, you know, dealt with by only women. I mean, Graham, what have you made of this?
Not just turning them away, but not telling them about Beera's Place, which is J.K. Rowling's Rape Crisis Centre, which gives that guarantee that there will be no men administering help, you know, or whatever the phrase is when it comes to therapy. So, it's absolutely extraordinary. But I've been writing about this bloke, excuse me, but Midrul Wadha, for like a couple of years now.
You can call him a bloke on this podcast.
Yeah, I know. But I've been writing about him for a few years now. And what I don't understand why it's not a bigger scandal, because I don't think I've seen anyone mention it yet, is a story that we reported on. He and his partner made a lot of money from closing down rape crisis centres in Scotland. Mm. You know, these contracts are pretty big. So I don't understand why people haven't knitted some of that together to add to the scandal, because obviously it's clearly a scandal on its own.
I mean, it's interesting because there's many, it would already, you would think, be scandalous, the fact that having a man run a rape crisis centre, and then you have, you know, what's been revealed over the through the course of this tribunal, that essentially, you know, discriminating against gender critical staff members, turning away, you know, essentially calling, you know, vulnerable women bigots, putting them in putting their emails in a folder marked hate.
Yeah. And I've received two emails from women who say that they're self-excluding from Scottish Rape Crisis Services purely because of WADHA, you know. And also, I think special mention should go to, there's a podcast called The Guilty Feminist.
Oh, yes.
They are the ones that interviewed WADHA and allowed him to get away with some of these phrases that you're talking about. I think the exact one was something like, even bigots can be the victims of sexual violence. Oh, yeah. Like that.
And women should learn to reframe their trauma.
And, yes, you know,
yeah.
Because he's a man and he thinks that men should be allowed to do this job. It's one of these scandals that just keep tumbling out of this movement, but you can't get people to cover it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, Joe Bartosz will cover it. You guys will cover it.
Yeah.
But as soon as it gets out into the Times has been very good. And the Mail, sorry. Now I sound like that Python sketch about the Romans. But there's been a few good newspapers.
But you won't see it in the BBC.
You won't see it in the BBC. You won't see it in any of the, what you might call the liberal system. And
which is where change happens. When those people pay attention to something, then bizarrely, it has a consequence.
Yeah, know? Ireland at the moment is a very good example of you know, rule by Twitter. Mm-hmm. You know, it is literally what is popular on Twitter is whatever they're doing. You know, and I think that this is a similar story in terms of the way people are covering this issue. You know, I keep thinking of it like an aristocracy. I think it's an aristocracy. Mm. Mm. It's a group. I mean, you notice they turn off replies on their messages. They they just ignore things that that don't suit them, like the caste review, stuff like that. So it's an aristocracy, and your opinions, which is why they turn off replies, are of no value to them.
No, or worse, they can get you in trouble, get you cancelled, get you arrested,
send the police after you. Is often the case. But I think that the rape crisis centre is similar to the women's prisons part of the whole gender debate in demonstrating just. It's not a new point, but the abject misogyny of this, because misogyny, the hatred of women effectively, I think really plays out in a situation where you are dealing with someone who's been the victim of domestic violence, rape, sexual assault, whatever, is there for a place of safe haven and treatment. And high up your agenda for dealing with this person is to insist they effectively check their privilege and interrogate their own biases. It is also to completely overwhelm their own wishes to only be treated by women. It's also the fact that the idea of a women's shelter is also a safeguarding idea. It's not, which is the fact that while it's not to suggest that all men will take advantage of vulnerable women if given the opportunity, there's a small subset of them who will, and therefore you have these blanket protections as a consequence. And the prison thing is a perfect example. The fact that you have, whether it's in a rape crisis center or it's in a women's prison, you are dealing with, by definition, the most vulnerable women in society, and that you're happily putting them not just in second place but third or fourth or fifth place to the demands of ideology or individuals who believe themselves to be something that they are not. It's mind-boggling, even if we have seen so many examples of it in recent years.
Yeah,
that's the thing. One of the problems we've had, those of us who were talking about this early, is that people just didn't believe us. Because you would think that a rapist in a woman's prison is enough scandal to keep to get an inquiry going for a year, right? And then you'd think that men taking women's prizes in sport would be enough to launch an inquiry into what's going on in sport at the moment. I think sport football recently, ITV, in fact, ITV hid replies on a decision by sport football to include trans women in the women's league. And all the replies are negative, you know? Anyway, sorry, I didn't want to get back onto that. But scandal after scandal after scandal. Amy Challoner in Stonewall. When? Why did that scandal not happen? Her father was a rapist and he tortured a child in the attic of their home. And Amy Challoner said nothing about it while he was at Stonewall, while he was with the Greens. Sean Berry silenced a whistleblower, Andy Healy, who tried to get the story out. Where are all these scandals? Do you know what I mean? It's like they seem to only happen on certain occasions, like, I guess it was the case being resolved. But do we really have to wait that long every time for what we know to be? We know it's not a good idea to put sex offenders in women's prisons. We know it's not a good idea to turn away rape victims because they don't like men. If anyone has a fucking license to not like men, it's victims of rape. So I just don't understand why. I guess people just need to see it go through the courts before they'll make a decision. You know?
But do you sometimes feel like, you know, you must feel like you're banging your head against the wall because, you know, you've been involved in this discussion for many, many years now. And people just, their reaction is often just say, oh, that's transphobic, or you shouldn't say that. It's not polite.
It's basically, I mean, I often say that, like, my biggest crime was betraying the middle class, because trans ideology is a middle class movement believed by middle class people. People in places of privilege that will never need a woman's shelter, that will never need a rape crisis center. And they simply do not appreciate or understand what's going on for women on the ground, like Sandy Toksvig, who's a famous trans ally. You know, she does not understand that lesbians are being coerced on their own dating apps into having sex with men. If she doesn't, you know, and she doesn't understand it because she knows that if she looks at it too closely, if she scrutinizes it, she'll find herself on the same side as me. You know, and that's not a comfortable place to be.
And how do you feel? I know we want to talk about the Middle East, but how do you feel about the Johnny come latelys as well? Because that's one thing which I slightly struggle with. Because on the one hand, particularly after the caste review, there was a number of prominent Labour MPs who sort of came out and said what they should have said a long time ago. There's a lot of people who are kind of, I almost think they're kind of quietly backing away from the crime scene and kind of pretending they didn't have much to do it in the first place. On the one hand, I'm glad that at least the penny has dropped amongst some people. But the fact that they were either silent or actually complicit in the demonization of the critics, I mean, how do you respond to those people who have only now got it? And even so, only kind of slightly.
I don't know. I mean, you know, the thing is, this everything I've been doing for the last 4 or 5 years has been trying to get those people over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And trying to make them understand what's going on. So it would be bad of me to suddenly start, you know, being angry that they've turned up, you know. It was a weird thing. And I do have some sympathy for people who were fooled. Some people's hearts are too big for their brains. And they just think that it feels like a compassionate thing to do.
Yeah.
But they were tricked. They were tricked by a whole kind of range of very different and dangerous people, from the predators taking advantage of it to the con men to the very disturbed parents of who say they've got a trans 3-year-old. Tell you an interesting thing that I don't think enough people know about, and I always have to be careful because it's kind of a hard thing to explain, but one of the things that I think it was the interim cast review found out was that in these gender clinics of, say, parents bringing a child in to be transitioned, there was, quote unquote, an overrepresentation of parents whose first child had died and was the opposite sex.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, where is the scandal? Why didn't that happen?
Yeah.
That's an extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
If that's why if parents who are so grief-stricken that they're trying to recreate their first child, you know,
and you see similar, so, you know.
Those are the people I have sympathy. They were fooled. They were tricked.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, there are some less sympathetic parents as well who didn't want to have gay children. That was a recurring story from many of the Tavistock whistleblowers.
I don't think either set of parents are sympathetic in that way. I think it's crazy in both. It's just insanity. But the thing is, this insanity works in a different ways on different groups of people.
Yeah.
As you say, homophobes, they get to just, you know, never have to face their friends with their gay kid. Oh no, he's a woman now. And if you disagree, then you get beaten up, you know, or cast out, you know. It's a gift for homophobic parents.
And also, I mean, I suppose another thing that maybe is sort of sympathetic to the Johnny Come Latelys is the fact that, well, all the people they've trusted have gone along with this.
Yeah,
the BBC,
absolutely.
The NHS,
the institution, the capture of the institutions were so important in all of this because, you know, people don't read up on everything all the time. They're not going to be across all of the information on gender medicine or what have you. But if they looked on an NHS website, if they read who was pointed to as the kind of authority on this, whether it's WPATH or anyone else. These are institutions which are taken seriously by the British state. They take their guidance. These people are supposedly academically accredited experts and so on. And they were all singing from the same hymn sheet. The fact that it was all complete mumbo jumbo was, you can understand why they weren't aware of that, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, but then again, you know, there's another scandal that didn't happen. I mean, it's so weird because these stories just kind of came out and just nothing happened to them, you know. But one of the big ones that meant that, I think, is one of the reasons why WPATH took out their latest standards of care. They bring them out every so often. I'm not sure if it's every year, but they took their latest one down off the website because it was revealed by the cast review, but also previously by Redux, that it was linking to a site full of child pornography about castration.
Is this the Eunuch Archives?
The Eunuch Archives, yeah. There were something like 4,000 stories and something like 40% of them were tagged minor, right? So this is WPATH, supposedly the world leader on healthcare, sharing a child pornography site about the thing they're doing to kids. It's like, again, what does it take to get a scandal
hiding
going?
In plain sight doesn't quite cover it.
It does, you know. No, and I think one of the reasons why it's worked is because as a wave of things, it's been very demoralizing. And as you say, you're trying to get people to realize what's going on, and it's so hard because you know, there's activists installed. And I just found out the other day, to find a way to get my book in, but I just found out the other day that my publisher says that people are writing to him and saying that when they get my book back, pages are glued together, you know? So when they order it from shops and stuff. So it's just an extraordinary kind of wall of misinformation and smears and fear-mongering, and it's got everyone terrified.
So at the weekend, we had the death of Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi, Tom, do you think he'll be missed by the Iranian people or by the
world? Certainly not by the thousands of dissidents that he sent to their death. Certainly not by the hundreds upon hundreds of women who have been arrested and brutalized at protests, part of the Women, Life, Freedom movement. I mean, he's directly responsible, really, in a sense, for the death of Mahsa Amini, the Iranian Kurd, who, for not wearing her hijab quite correctly, she was wearing it, but just not correctly, was effectively sent to her death. This is such a horrendous, tyrannical individual. And it's been striking to see the sort of responses to it because, I mean, you've got Hezbollah and Hamas, you know, passing on their condolences. That's to be expected. But to see, you know, the UN having a minute of silence and the flag at half mast and the BBC putting out an obituary which gestured to his sort of complicated legacy because, yes, he brutalised all of these people. But, you know, he introduced some good social reforms. He was a good guy, really. It really reminded me of
when... He cut a backlog in court cases.
He did, which, look at our backlog at the moment. Yeah. So who are we to judge? It really reminded me of, was it the Washington Post who after... Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, was killed. They referred to him as an austere religious scholar. And I think there is something to this, which is that sort of Western mainstream media, as well as sort of progressive circles generally, they have this real sort of stutter that sets in whenever they have to talk about Islamist regimes. Mm. They're very comfortable criticizing almost any other type of regime. But for whatever reason, where Islamism comes into the equation, they can't quite get the words out. Yeah. And I think you've seen it in relation to the silence on the Women, Life, Freedom protests generally. And the reasons for it are quite obvious, I think. First of all, is that they have this sort of bigotry of low expectations, which has now been applied like geopolitically. So because in the stupid schema that they have, Muslims are forever the underdogs, even if they're part of an Islamist regime who are tyrannizing their own people. I think that plays into it. They feel like they're going to feed some sort of Islamophobic narrative if you criticize these regimes too harshly. And then it's also interacts with that sort of phony anti-imperialism they have, which is now just really anti-Westernism, which is they're bothered by repressive states if you can trace the trail of breadcrumbs back to Washington, D.C., if they're being propped up by the U.S., if they're being funded by the U.S., if they're an ally of the U.S. But if it's a regime doing it if it's of their own accord, they just don't really care. Yeah. It's particularly if they're a state like Iran, which has sort of tried to position itself very cynically as the kind of challenge to Western hegemony in that part of the world. So I think what was interesting in the slightly strange, confused, muddled reaction to his death, I'm not saying people should be, you know, take to Twitter to openly celebrate it, but even mealy-mouthedness I think was interesting and revealed a lot of those sort of trends that we see.
And you know, Graham, then Tom brought up the anti-hijab protests. You'd think that is, the morals there are so clear-cut. These are, you know, women protesting for their freedom, being attacked and repressed by the state for it. And yet there is this kind of, there hasn't been the kind of solidarity you'd hope for from Westerners, from whether that's Western feminists or Westerners generally. What do you make of that? I mean, it's...
Well, you know, one of the regular features we have in our website is a weekly roundup of stories in the gender, you know, world. And we call it the war on women, you know? And I don't think that's, I mean, I'm given to hyperbole, but I don't think that's hyperbole. Yeah. I think it is a war on women. I think, for instance, that after October 7th, it wouldn't have been possible for people to come out in the streets supporting Palestine before Israel had even mounted a response.
Yeah.
Without what has been a steady chipping away at how much we value women in society. We've had like years of things like women being called white women to try and shut them up. There's been all sorts of these little things picking at people. As I say, the demoralizing effect of all this, the fact that we can't get people to care about women in prison with sex offenders, it's very demoralizing. And I would imagine it's similar to how people living under the Iranian regime, which was not always a theocratic regime, we've allowed our idea of women to become degraded, whereby, you know, not even, it's considered rude to say the word in NHS documents, you know? So, of course, after a while, you were talking about Novara Media and people like that, they're able to just ignore it completely.
Yeah.
Because it's like not... because women are so, you know, have just lost all value to people on the left, you know?
Yeah, and you mentioned October 7th, and, you know, there has been this extraordinary denial of, you know, particularly the crimes against women in particular have been denied. And there are people at the moment today planning to protest a documentary about October 7th, particularly about the attack on the Nova Festival, because they see that as Zionist propaganda to actually, you know, reveal that women were abducted and raped.
And and they released that footage yesterday, that awful footage of them talking about how they were going to rape them and impregnate them. Yeah. You know, it's like, I don't know, I think that I used to think that, you know, because we were all connected, atrocities wouldn't happen. But the only difference is that people just started filming them.
Yeah.
Like the people themselves started filming them. I'm struggling at the moment with whether to share the website This Is Hamas with everyone who comes to me about this. And it's like, because I don't want to watch those videos, you know?
Yeah.
But you know, I think people who are making the argument that Hamas should be supported in any way or rewarded for what happened on October 7th, they should watch those videos.
Yeah.
You know?
And actually that brings us on nicely to really important intervention from Salman Rushdie.
Right now, if there was a Palestinian state, it would be run by Hamas, and that would make it a Taliban-like state, and it would be a client state of Iran. Is that what the progressive movements of the Western left wish to create?
Now, Tom, I mean, Rushdie is someone who supports the Palestinian cause and has done for decades, but he seems to be one of the few people who's sort of finally recognized that right now that means Hamas, that means terror, rewarding terror.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's also, and Daniel Ben-Ami made this point in his piece about Rushdie and his intervention that he wrote for Spike this week, which is to say that there's also this confusion. First of all, there's this desire to downplay what Hamas is, the atrocities that it's been responsible for, not just against Israeli civilians, but even against its own civilians.
Yeah.
There is a complete wall of silence on those particular questions and a lack of recognition that any state presided over by an organization like that would be horrendous, not just for people who neighbor it, but also people who live within it. The other thing that it fails to take into account is the fact that Hamas is not like a national liberation movement. It's essentially the Palestinian wing of the Muslim Brotherhood. This is they have a kind of apocalyptic Islamist ideology. They want to set up a caliphate. This is not about this proud nation must have its own sovereignty. This is a much darker movement, and it's actually a real tragedy for the Palestinian people that they have come to be represented in that part of the world by these genocidal lunatics who have no aspirations really for any kind of genuine nation state, but for an Islamist jihadist tyranny. And the lack of appreciation of that, and to see people not take, just rebuffing what comments that Rushdie has made, or also to see this week the leaders of Ireland, Norway and Spain declare their support for a Palestinian state, recognition of a Palestinian state off the back of everything that's happened.
Yeah.
Naive doesn't cover it. I mean, it's basically rewarding fascism.
Yeah, and it's not. And as you say, you know, those are world leaders. We're not just talking about
people on silly Twitter or whatever.
People on idiots on Twitter, silly people on protests.
This but again, you know, that's what I mean by rule by Twitter in Ireland. Like, you know, he basically did that because it will go down well with Irish Twitter, which is particularly insane at the moment, you know.
Particularly on this issue, it seems.
Particularly on this issue. And it's like, I mean, it's very close to my other hobby horse, because it's full of people who are doing things because it feels like the right thing to do, or it feels good, or you feel like, and it's like, you know, so, and the best example of how that heart versus head problem is not working out is Queers for Palestine. You know, because they, as people are often pointing out, gay people wouldn't survive a second in Palestine being openly queer, the political meaning of the political word for gay. You know, no, that's not going to happen. And yet they cannot seem to, they will criticize someone for voting against gay marriage, but they won't criticize someone for throwing gay people off a rooftop. You know what I mean? It's just nuts. I don't know how they can live with the cognitive dissonance, you know.
We should also talk about the ICC issuing indictments against both Israeli leaders and Hamas's leaders. Tom, I mean, doesn't this create a bizarre kind of false equivalence?
Absolutely. And the attempt to suggest that it doesn't, I think, is ridiculous. I mean, first of all, it seems to make a fundamental confusion between a genocidal terror organization who was beheading people, raping women, taking hostages, and a nation which is defending itself and trying to crush that clearly near and present threat. Obviously, within that, there are all kinds of criticisms that can be leveled at the Israeli government for how they conduct their business and how they're conducting this war. But to suggest that they, as they allege, are purposely targeting civilians is something that clearly doesn't stack up. There's the points about the fact that, you know, singling them out for criticism for sealing the border in the wake of what? October the 7th.
Yeah.
And there have been thousands upon thousands of aid trucks which have made it through those border crossings, much fewer than are needed, it seems, and that's a tragedy. But to say that this, effectively, that a just war amounts to a war crime,
yeah,
I think is a profound moral confusion. And the idea that they are just trying to call this as even as possible, yes, we're, you know, indicting Hamas, therefore we're also indicting Israel, also I think fails to take into account the fact that this is clearly an intervention which has been welcomed by the anti-Israel side. I mean,
yeah,
you know, basically coming into conflict with international law is not something that a group like Hamas are particularly worried by. It is not something that will impact upon their ability to operate. Very whereas because point. Of the fact that Israel are reliant on support from their allies, if it ever did get to the point of this arrest warrant being issued, then any of the nations which are signed up to the ICC would be under an obligation to arrest someone like Netanyahu if he arrived in their country. So this is quite clearly something which will have a material impact on their ability to make representations to the various nations that they rely on and that they're allied with. And also morally has just been a complete boon to all of the Israelophobes who have just wanted to, frankly, not even just draw a moral equivalence, but suggest that Israel were the far more malign actor in the midst of all of this. So I'm not surprised that it's happened. I felt like it was almost inevitable, unfortunately. This is kind of the nature of the international human rights sector. It has a very strong anti-Israel bias. But the inability to recognise what a shocking intervention this is from neutral observers, I find very strange.